Mr. Hutton, Reel 12. So what happened? You'd been on Malta with this job you didn't like on the island.
Well, then the invasion took place. And we landed at Syracuse in Sicily. And it was we landed fairly late in the morning, I think.
Of the same day?
Only a few hours after after the commanders and everybody had landed. But it was perfectly quiet. We seemed to have got air superiority and all that sort of thing. And I just drove my motorbike over the things and landed. We all did. And it was an invasion, but it was, as far as I was concerned, it was quite an easy one. And we stayed in Syracuse for a day or two. There was a lot of air raids at night. And in the sort of where we were stationed, this little house that we're all living in, sort of in the backyard, there was a naval multiple pump on, those things that go like that, you know, out four pump. I didn't know it was there, and there was an air raid in the middle of the night, and this thing started going off outside the window. I wonder what the hell it was to start with. And then we got really busy. I was given an Italian chap from the pool of interpreters, and we went off to a place called Noto.
Just the two of you?
Yeah. And there we're going to see the army had advanced again, and there was nobody there. All the civilians were there. An Allied military government, AMGOT, they'd come in and taken over, and they seemed absolutely clueless. Mind you, they're all new to the game. I suppose they'd never done it before. Done a bit of it in North Africa. There was nothing there really to govern in North Africa. And they'd start to carry on with the administration. To make it easy for them, they used the Italians that were already there, the mayors and goodness knows what. And some of them were hardline fascists, had been pretty bad, you know. And the Allied military government was still using them. And we had to go on arrest and bring up certain people. I had to go and arrest the mayor of the town and take him into Syracuse. And this Allied military governor wouldn't let me. Well, I'd had my orders and he'd got his orders, and I'd only got one stripe, and he was a major, and he was a Knight of Malta. I can't remember his name, but he was a very got his job through his, you know, not because he was, but because he was somebody very high up. And then he was a, I know he was a Knight of Malta, and I can't remember his name, but he was an absolute bloody fool. And he'd got some real bad eggs running the town. And when I told him I was taking the mayor in, he nearly threatened to put me under arrest. It's very, very hard to do a job with one stripe on your arm. And we arrested a lot of people and took them in. But the snag was, the Americans were there as well. And you could take in some big fry, big stuff. And it wasn't very long before they were let out. The Americans had let them out again. And the only people who stayed in was perhaps the chauffeurs of these fascists. If they got locked, they're probably still locked up now. But the people that mattered soon had the influence to get themselves out.
How would you know who to arrest?
I don't know. We'd told who we'd got to go and get, you see.
So you didn't do the intelligence side of it?
We were just told who we'd got to go and get and what we'd got to do. And we were chasing. When we get to all these towns, usually found who we were after had gone. Well, I think, but I don't know this, is that one of these chaps that we'd been chasing all this time, Triple in, was now in Sicily. and unless my imagination's too big, but there were so we're always having to go after somebody who was never there. And the same go we were going after somebody in Sicily, and we eventually caught up with this chap, and he was a mayor of some place, and we went there to arrest him, and he got him, and he was there. They don't know why we were fetching him in, I do not know.
Did they object when you arrested them?
Oh yes, well, I'm going to tell you about this. He was there with all his family and his grand and his parents, and we went in there and we were going to take him. We surrounded the place, and there was about six or seven of us there, including this Captain Pollock and the Sergeant Major, and we went in there and we sort of arrested him, and his daughters and his, they played up such hell with us, and a little old man came up to me, it'd be his father or his grandfather, and I had to sort of push him to one side like this with my Tommy gun, you know. I didn't mean to do the chap any harm, but he sort of went flying across the room and landed up in the corner. If it had been filmed, it would have made me look like the worst of the Gestapo. But I didn't. I just happened to... had to push him away, you see. And he went flying across the room, and I think if anybody had been there and had taken photographs of it, I should have been had up for being a war criminal, I think. I can remember that. That was very unpleasant. But when you got to go and... we'd arrested quite a lot of people, but when you've got a lot of screaming wives and daughters, it's not a very nice job. Because that didn't happen very often. But by Jove, whilst we're in Sicily, we rounded an awful lot up. But I reckon as fast as we brought them into the this compound where they got them, the ones that were powerful, the ones that mattered, had influence to get out. And I think it was only the small fry, but I think we were learning the job. I think by the time the field security got to the Normandy and in France and Germany, they knew the job, you see. But we were sort of learning. It's never happened before, has it? But we were... And anyway, we had a very busy time there in Sicily. This Allied military governor, I mean, I wasn't falling out with him all. I had all this trouble with him to start with. There was a brothel in the town. And this little interpreter, the doctor, the Italian doctor, had told him that he wouldn't go near these women unless he got wearing a Wellington. And... So we knew that they were bad. And I told this Allied military governor about it because British army lorries kept going there, you see. And we'd tell them that it wasn't safe to be there. Well, they wouldn't take any notice of us because they thought we wanted the girls for ourselves, you see. So I got the Italian, the carpenter in the village town, to make a great big notice and painted on, "These girls are infected. You have been warned." And I made the brothel owner stick it up outside his building. Well, that still didn't stop them coming. There was always army trucks out there. But before all this, we went in there when we first found the place, and there was a couple of Canadian deserters living there. And I had two big tough chaps. There was only me there, and this little interpreter was frightened of, you know, wouldn't say boo to a goose. I had to talk myself out of there because I reckon these Italian, Canadian deserters would have done for me. And I went back and told this military governor, and he told me to put the place out of bounds. It wasn't my job. It was more Red Cap's job, you see. And this military governor decided he wanted a police force. And there was a prison there, Noto Prison. It was quite a big jail. And we'd been in there to have a look, to see what was... I'd been with this interpreter, and it appears there was a lot of Senussi tribesmen there who had been brought over from North Africa. The Italians had brought him over, or the Germans, because they'd been helping British airmen escape and things like that. And there was quite a few of them locked up in there for helping British airmen to escape. Another Senussi was in prison in there because he'd pinched cut a telephone wire, one of these ones a lot like the army have along there. He'd cut a bit of that to tie his camel up with, hobble his camel with, you see. And he was locked up in there. And I'd told this AMGOT officer about that. So he sent me in there with this interpreter to sort a few of them out and bring them out, and he was going to make them into a sort of police force. So I went in there, and it was supposed to be, because they'd opened one great, the Italian, still run by the Italians, although the war was still, they locked one gate in and you went in that, and they locked that behind, and you went through another iron gate and they locked that and you went in. Well, you're virtually a prisoner inside the prison. Now I'm never going to get out the place again. But anyway, we brought about a dozen of these Senussi tribesmen out, and this military government bloke went and got them some khaki shorts and khaki shirts and got them some boots and fitted that and made them into a sort of policeman to look after the place. And then we moved on to invade Italy. Well, we went to Messina, which is just right opposite the toe of Italy. And that was very interesting because we were right on the seafront, and the Nelson was out there doing one of these with its big guns bombarding the place. It was a wonderful sight, that was. And next morning, we drove ashore into Italy. Never saw an aeroplane, never heard a bang or anything. It was another invasion that was full, you know, very nice, easy landing. I mean, I've said to people when I got home, I've been on this, I've done that, and I've been on two invasions, but never told them that it was easy as that. So we got into Italy and we thought it was going to be interesting. But then the armistice was declared. You know, they had an armistice. We'd only been in Italy a day or two. And we seemed to lose all our powers. Because you couldn't... nobody, no matter what people had done, they weren't going to be locked up. And so, really, we were just looking around for loot, wine and...
Why was that? What caused you to lose your powers? I'm not quite...
Because of this armistice had been, they were no longer the enemy. It was sort of, the armistice was declared, there was Italian soldiers hanging about the street, nothing to do. I drove into one village, and it was full of Italian prisoners. They were standing about in, and I was in a hurry, and I couldn't get through, and I was in a hurry to get to somewhere. I was blowing my horn and they wouldn't get out of my way. I was on my motorbike and there's a whole ring of them in the middle of the road. So I get out the bloody way, blew my horn, and they all stepped to one side, and it was a great big bomb crater. deepest. I drove my motorbike straight into it. I didn't feel a bloody fool. And it, you know, it shook me a bit. I grazed myself and knocked me. Anyway, these Italians helped me pull my motorbike out. Well, there was a bit of delay, though, because it was one of those matchlesses that had those sort of sprung, sort of a bit that concertinaed inside the other, sort of, I don't know what, instead of just springs, it was a sort of, I went in, sort of like hydraulic sort of things. Don't know how they worked. Then it all spread out like this in a hell of a leg. But the Italians helped me put it together away. I did feel a bloody fool, and on I drove. But it was it was a damn thing. You'd nearly driven a bus into this hole.
So what's the next, after the armistice and you lost your powers, what happened then?
Then I moved forward to a place where I went with this chap, Joe Benici. I think I told you about him last night.
Not on tape, though. Who was Joe Benici?
Joe Benici was at the beginning of the war. No, Joe Benici's great-great-great-grandfather was a Corsican pirate who helped Nelson in the Battle of somewhere in the Mediterranean, or the Battle of the Nile, or somewhere it was, something. And because of that, he was given British nationality. So that made Joe Bonici. Because his great-great-grandfather was a Corsican pirate that helped Nelson at the Battle of the Mile, and that made Joe a British subject. So when the war broke out, Joe, I think, lived in Tunis, came and joined up in 1939. And he couldn't speak. He spoke about six or seven languages, but he could only speak a little bit of English. And he wasn't treated very well, really, considering what he'd done. And it wasn't till he'd been in the army a bit that they seemed to realise he was very good on languages. So they put him into the intelligence corps. And later on in Africa, when we were in Tunis, he didn't want to go into Tunis because of his letting his friends and relations down, you know. But they made him do it. And I think they offered him this is the story he told me, and I think there must have been some truth in it, that they even offered him a commission if he'd be dropped behind the enemy line somewhere in Italy, dropped somewhere, I don't know, and he wouldn't do it, because Joe was ever such a nice chap, but he wasn't a bloke for taking a lot of risks.
When did you meet him yourself?
Well, he was he'd been in our section all the time, but I'd never had anything much to do with him. He'd always been on other jobs. He was the brains of our lot. I think any good results that we'd done in the war, I mean, what I'd done wouldn't have made any difference. The war wouldn't have been any shorter by half an hour if I hadn't been there. But I think Joe did plenty whilst all the time I was there. I don't know what he did to justify our existence.
And he was a sergeant?
He was a sergeant.
So this is when you were... After Messina, you were put with him, were you?
Yeah.
What was he like as a bloke then?
Oh, I liked him, and he was... But he just... He wasn't a very aggressive... So he wasn't... He didn't like taking risks and things like that. And he was clever, but I suppose I went along to give him a bit of backup. He had to keep, it was no good him being on his own. He didn't like to be on his own. And so we went off to Cosenza. I don't know why we were going, but I went with him. I was really, you might call this backup, I suppose. And we went to this town in Cosenza, we got a nice billet. The mayor found us a place to live, and I hadn't been there very long, and he sent me about 20 miles away to some place where there was a form of concentration camp, but it was mostly Italian civilians. They were probably anti-fascist or Masons. See, Mussolini kept the Masons down. And various business, and there was a lot of people from some state symphony orchestra or something. They were there, and I had to bring this woman out. She was an Italian countess of some sort, a very attractive woman.
Do you know why?
No. I had to fetch her out. I'd got this bit of paper to fetch her out of this place. You see, the armistice was still on. They weren't really prisoners, these people were, but they had to stay there because there was nowhere else for them to go, and there was the war on, you see. They were prisoners, and yet they weren't. But I took these papers with her to fetch her out, and she had a great big cabin trunk, the sort of things that were used before the war the wealthy people took on liners. It was this sort of great big cabin. And it just fitted into this motorbike sidecar that I'd got. It was a big German auto Guzzi thing. And she sat on the pillion seat, and I brought her in. And she spent a lot of time with Joe. And she must have given him some information, because she went off and came back the next day with two or three chaps. There was one chap had a great big, wore a great big trilby hat, a huge thing, and he'd got a cigarette and a long cigarette holder and a cane, more like out of a Hollywood film than anything else. And she took him into Joe Benici's, and they spent hours talking. And he was something to do with organising labour, Italian compulsory labour, if you like, to go up to, you know, very nearly to Austria, somewhere northern Italy. And that's where they were getting all their information from. And I think it was something like Piedmont or something that was either a ball bearing factory or this flying bomb job. It was something to do with this labour that had gone up there that was all very, very secret. So I'll never know to this whether that's my fertile imagination, but we were doing the job for some reason. We weren't doing it for just for the fun of it. And we had a lot of... It was quite a busy little town, and it had been bombed by...
Just to finish that last thing, what happened? You have an opinion about what they used that information for, haven't you?
Yes, but it was to find out. I think Joe found out where this, whatever this factory was, and I think it was very important exactly where it was, and I think they bombed that. And it'd come a hell of a long way to get round to it. I don't know, but it was a hell of a long flight. They'd gone with big bombers to bomb it. And I think that was something to do with Joe Benici, because I think he got mentioned in dispatches. He got mentioned in dispatches, and he certainly didn't get mentioned in dispatches for bravery. That's one thing he wouldn't have got. I think he got it because he was good at his job. But I don't know, but it makes a good story, and I think until somebody tells me different, that's what I believe it was.
Now, what about this sort of thing about the bomb?
Oh, it had been bombed by the Americans had bombed this place earlier on, and none of the bombs had gone off. There was great big bombs in people's gardens, just sitting, just sticking in the ground or lying on the floor, and Joe couldn't, he was so busy with this job he was doing, the interviewing. The mayor kept pestering him about these bombs, you see. Well, the bomb disposal people were much too busy. They couldn't come to there, busy doing the job they were supposed to be doing. And this mayor wanted Joe to arrange for bomb disposal people to come. So he told him he'd already got a bomb disposal. Joe said he'd already got a bomb disposal expert here now, and it was me. So I had a stethoscope.
Could you just explain why you'd had some connection with bomb disposal informally, hadn't you? What was it?
Well, way back in Sicily, I'd one of the places I'd lived for a bit. I'd attached myself to a bomb disposal unit. I used to feed with them, only for feeding. I wasn't doing a deal of anything there. But I used to go there and eat with them, and I slept with them. And we went off one day to... on my rounds, I'd seen some pigs running around. The farm had left the farm, and these pigs were running around free. And I took a chap with me from this bomb disposal group who'd been a butcher. And we went off to get one of these pigs. And they're quite big. I think they weighed about 4 stone, 4 or 5 stone apiece. And we tried to catch the damn thing, and we couldn't. They were running around free. So I shot it in the leg. Awful cruel thing to do, really. I shot it in the leg so as we could catch it. And shot it with the 38 revolver I'd got. No, it wasn't. It was a 45. And we caught the damn thing. And it was squealing. And we put it on the motorbike. On my motorbike. This chap had it. He sat on the pillion. We had this pig between us. We took it back, and he killed it, and we ate it. So, you know, I lived, we had a bit of good fun. But I used to see them. They'd got bombs, they would sit on the bombs, they'd sit astride them and knock at them, hammer away, and there was chisels and spanners, and they knocked them about, something terrible, they weren't. And my theory was that if they'd fallen out of an aeroplane and hadn't gone off, they weren't likely. So I used to go into these people's gardens, walk up to the bomb with my stethoscope, listen, say it was all right, and go away again.
This is back at Cosenza.
Back at Cosenza. That's how I became the bomb disposal expert. It sounds a tall story, but it's true.
Did any of them go off?
No, well, I don't think. We were only there for a week or two, and then we'd gone. So if any went off...
Did it make the local, the civilians?
Oh, it quietened them down. They were satisfied. They all went back to the houses after I'd told them it was all right. But any...
So what else were you doing at Cosenza Bar? Olivia, sort of making people feel better?
Well, look, I was having grapes every day for breakfast and things like that. And I had a lot of Spumante, champagne.
Did you go out?
One place I went to. I had to go up the mountains, and I was driving so high up in the mountains somewhere that the motorbike started to splutter and cough. And where I was only in a shirt, and you know, I was cold. And I came to I'd got to go somewhere. There was a bridge across a great ravine, and you could see down the tops of the trees. This bridge, and I can't remember where it was or anything, but there was only the two sort of big girders that went across, and all the boards that went across had been the Germans, I said, had pulled them all off so as nobody could cross it. And I thought, well, I'm not taking that. If those girders had been on the ground, I could have driven my motorbike straight across, but I wasn't going to go across there, just on my motorbike. Do you know what I mean? You're a great height up, and you can look down and see the tops of the trees.
And you didn't like heights?
No, and I didn't like, and I was, mind you, I think it would only be a madhead who would have taken a run at it and driven across. But as I say, if that girder had been on the ground, I could have driven across it. But I wasn't going to go over that lot. Oh, and just before I got to this bridge, somebody started shooting at me, and I knew it'd have to be a damn good shot to hit somebody on a motorbike from a long way away going fast. But these bullets kept whistling, about three or four of them whistled over me, so I went ever so fast and zigzagged and got out the way. I don't know who that was, because the armistice was on, you know, the Italians had, and the Germans had retreated up, so I expect it was some Italian fascist that shot at me. And then I got to this bridge, and I thought, well, I'm not going to go over that. So I stood and waited and wondered what I was going to do, and the funny old broken-down Italian lorry came along. And I made them lift my motorbike onto the lorry, and we drove across. But I can't... What worries me about the story is I can remember that as plain. I don't know how I got back, or whether there was another way back or what, because I can remember...